I am now going to take you on a tour around the campsite. I hope you enjoy. I have just walked through the gate and there is a massive banner saying "Reclaim the Power." And there are these boards for disabled people or people with hard time walking, for example, pushchairs. And I'm just going to go in the welcome tent with colourful bunting. I will report back when I have more information. What is your main job here?
My main job here is to learn about fracking and learn about how to make the sort of changes in the world that we want to see. And I've also brought the Green Energy Exploration Dome with me and set up, which is being used for workshops. So I'm kind of supplying the space and looking after it. And today I'm doing a little shift on the welcome tent, welcoming people to the camp.
What does the welcome tent do?
The welcome tent says welcome to people and tries to answer as many questions as possible about things that people arriving at the camp want to know, where things are or what time things are happening, and any other questions that people might have about the camp.
What do you think about fracking personally?
Personally, on a gut level, I think that it's really rubbish and it seems like a completely mad thing to do, to try and get gas or oil out of the ground that might contaminate drinking water for maybe like a long time. But part of the reason why I'm here is to learn more about it so that I can know what the actual facts are, and I'm still learning.
Thank you, you've been a great help. Okay, I'm now at the media tent and I'm going to be interviewing a spokesman of this called Jamie.
Hello, Freddie. And hello, Residents FM. So what would you like to know about the media tent? Or shall I guess what you're going to ask me, which is, what do you do in the media tent?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. I'm a mind reader, but today I'm working in the media tent. And so it's a very strong team, very experienced, apart from me, but the rest of them are very, very experienced indeed. And really it's all about making sure that we meet all the press who turn up at the gates of the camp. So that could be BBC, ITV. This morning we had Al Jazeera, but also radio, newspapers, the Daily Mail. And we escort them around, make sure they don't take pictures, that people don't want pictures taken of them. And we answer their questions. Every morning we meet at 8 o'clock. And we talk about how our messages are going to be today, what our new messaging is going to be. We talk about how the reports went yesterday and how we can get our messages out more clearly. So it's planning what our main messaging is. It's also answering the media phone because it's constantly ringing. It's also sending out press releases. So it's really keeping on top of the whole media story and making sure we're representing the camp really well. So it's a lot to do with interacting, reacting with what's happening in the camp as well, and also responding to the wishes of the campers. So that's why it's very important not to let any camera people wander around and just film everybody. I mean, while I'm talking to you, Freddie, at the moment, just behind us there's a whole load of people who are having direct action training. So obviously that's not something that we'd want the press to be filming, you see. But that's mainly what the media does.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
You've been great help. We are now at the kitchen interviewing a chef. How many people do you normally cater for?
Normally? Well, we run a little cafe in Bradford, and normally we get maybe 20 or 30 people coming on. So last night we catered for about 450 people, so that was a bit of a step up. but we've done a couple of events like this before. Like we sometimes go up to a place called Menwith Hill in Yorkshire, where the American National Security Agency have got a spy base. You might have seen it's got all these like big golf balls, and basically every 4th of July they have an Independence from America protest. Mm-hmm. So we go up there and we make food for all the people that are there. And we went to the frack off, frack camp in Lancashire a couple of years ago. So, you know, we've got a bit of experience of doing this sort of thing. But not normally this many people. It's quite scary.
What do you normally cook?
Normally at the cafe, at the 1 and 12 Club, we have burgers and chips. So always a favourite.
In this camp, isn't it completely vegan? Why did they make that choice?
Mm. One of the best reasons for it is that it means that everybody can eat the food. So, you know, whether or not your diet's restricted because of your religion, you might not be able to eat certain types of meat. But you'll find quite often in these sorts of movements, you get quite a lot of people who are vegan. Because the reasons for being vegan are quite closely related to environmental reasons. You know, it takes so much land and so much energy to produce meat and milk and cheese that actually the most sustainable way right now is to eat a vegan diet, because it uses less energy and less water. And it just kind of makes sense. And also just in terms of like food safety, if we don't have any fridges or anything to store like milk or to store like meat, so it's much safer to eat vegan when you're in a camp like this. So you don't get ill. Yeah, we want people to be fit and strong. It's also quite a healthy diet as well.
Where'd you get the food from?
Well, a lovely lady made an enormous order of food for the whole camp. So we've basically got a tent full of food.
Is that the site office?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think a lot of it came from sort of farmers around here. I think some of it came from a food cooperative in Bristol called Essential. But lots of people have been donating food as well. Like lots of people from the village have come up with some like vegetables they've grown themselves in their gardens. Like someone came in with these massive marrows that were about as big as a leg, and we tried to put that in our stew last night. People have just been bringing along different bits and bobs. Somebody just brought along a bunch of little cakes, which you just ate.
Who works in the kitchen?
Well, everybody's volunteers. So we've got people from all different walks of life. We've got midwives in there, students, doctors. Basically, there's just a few of us came down with the kitchen from Bradford. And then every day we'd be getting floods of volunteers who are just in the camp who want to help we need help because
there's so many people.
So yeah, everybody basically is in the kitchen.
Thank you, you've been a great help.
Oh, thank you.
I'm now at the washing up station. How many people do you normally wash up?
It's hard to say because we just get a big heap of plates and pots and mugs, which seems to be never ending. And it's just a constant stream, really. So it's hard to kind of estimate. Yeah, because one person may use two cups.
How long are you here for? Like, how long is your shift?
It's not really a shift per se. It kind of is just a tag in, tag out. You just come up and you just come to help. There's no like timetable.
Right.
No one tells you when to start. No one tells you when to finish. There's just been like a constant stream of people who want to help, and you kind of just go along with that, really. Yeah. And I think also it's guided by how much washing up there is to do. So earlier there was a lot more. So there was at least four of us working. Whereas now there's not very much. It's just me.
Yeah. is this something you normally do, or is this something you normally do every day, or just
as a living? You mean?
No. At the camp, is this something you do every day, or is just something you just do every now and then?
It's something I've done every day, but I try to do it in the morning and try and correlate it around some of the workshops that are going on, because ultimately that's why I'm here, is to learn and to like interact with people. And if I can help out as much as I can, so just trying to work around the schedule of the camp.
Thank you, you've been a big help. Okay, how many people do normally come to the medic tent?
So in the last hour we've had about four people come, so it's not been too busy so far, and hopefully it'll stay that way.
What equipment do you have?
So we've got lots of basic first aid equipment, so cleaning, wipes and cleaning equipment, bandages, plasters, tape, basic analgesia, so things like paracetamol, ibuprofen, hydration therapy if anyone gets diarrhea, some ice packs if people have hurt themselves, and gloves and wash to make sure that we're all sterile in here.
How many people volunteer, or is it like shifts, or do they volunteer just like come and go?
So we have at the moment around 6 medically trained people on a rota, but anyone else who's done even basic first aid training or actually even would like some, it would be really great to have some more people helping out.
Okay. Thank you, been a great help. I am now at the legal tent. What is the legal tent's main role?
Okay, so at the legal tent we do several different things. So we are a base for running trainings for people to know about their rights on protest, and we also train people up to act as legal observers. And they are people who go out on the actions and monitor what the police are doing and make sure that people who are arrested have the support they need.
What is your main roles out of the legal tent?
So that's the legal observing on the protests. We're not just running a legal tent here, we always have our phone on 24/7, both here at the camp and outside of it throughout the year. And that's for support for protests around the country.
What can people come and see you for in the legal tent?
So if people are planning an action, they can come and see us and discuss what kind of things they might need to think about in terms of the law and the policing of their action. If they've been on an action and they've seen the police do something they shouldn't have done, or if they've seen an arrest, they can come here and make a witness statement and we can help that be followed up on. Or they can come here if they're interested in getting more involved and training as a legal observer, or just finding out a bit more about their rights for future protests.
Thank you, you've been a great help. I am now at the wellbeing tent. What sort of things do you do in the wellbeing tent?
Well, the wellbeing tent is a place for people to take time out, because it can be, some people find these spaces very stressful, they'd be doing a lot of work, and so this is somewhere where people don't need to think about organising things and can take some time to talk to people or just relax by themselves.
What kind of activities do you do here?
Well, yeah, so there's cups of teas, there's talking, some people are going to be doing some massages and other relaxation treatments, so like people bring what they want to share with people that they think will help with their well-being on site and us activists.
How many people did normally come here a day?
It depends. There's like a continuous flow of people. Normally got 3 or 4 people in. I think it might get a bit busier as people get more tired, and maybe after they've been on some action and maybe involved in some conflict situations over the next couple of days.
So are you expecting lots of people on Monday when the actual action is?
We might get lots of people on Monday evening and Tuesday.
Thank you, you've been a great help.
Tell us about the march that took place yesterday from the station down the road.
Okay, I went to the march yesterday, and it was a fantastic experience and probably a lifetime experience. I've never been on a march like that before. All the people were friendly, happy, smiling, doing their chanting. There were people there carrying babies, and there were 90-year-olds in wheelchairs. It was just the most amazing experience. And I met a couple of newspaper reporters as I was walking along. They were asking us questions because I was wearing a Balcombe t-shirt. And they said, "Are there many people from Balcombe here?" And so I immediately just looked around me in the small part of the march that I was in. It was, you know, over 1,000 people. And I just started pulling people towards me from them by their hands and saying, "He's from Balcombe, she's from Balcombe, they're from Balcombe." And they all came and stood around me, and there were just lots of us, just in that tiny bit of the march. And they were spread all the way through the march, people from Balcombe. So I thought that was great. The other amazing thing, I was just talking to everyone that I met, because that's what Balcombe people do anyway. And I talked to a couple who were walking past me, and they said they'd come on the train for the day from Dorset, which amazed me. And there were people there who'd come from Lancashire, because they'd been fracked there. And there were people from all over the country, and possibly even other countries, because I heard people speaking foreign languages. It was just a very amazing experience.
Did you get arrested?
Yeah, I got arrested yesterday when I was coming out from the toilet. I walked into the two line of police and the van parked there. They straight away took me in. They arrested me for a section 4A on a public order act, saying someone been threatened to the Kodula staff. They think it's me. So now I'm out on bail and they didn't charge me yet. I have to go back to the police station on 15th. Hopefully, if they have enough evidence to charge, I've been charged already. They're just harassing me to keep me out of the site. Which they put the bail condition today, give us the map with the bail condition. But they make a mistake. They forget to color this area. So because of their mistake, I managed to come back again.
And what happened while you were arrested?
Some of the quadrilla drilling staff, they say they recognize me as making a threat to them. So I'm denying it. I didn't do anything like that. But they, because of their word, they snatched me. But they don't have evidence to charge, so I had to go back to the police station on 15th. Hopefully they say it's no further action. But still it's a bit harassment because I have to sign on a police station twice a week at the moment.
Why did Deepak think that it was important to come down and to support the Reclaim the Power camp?
I think there's three reasons, really. One, to stand with the villagers and anybody else who's rejecting the climate or the energy policy, which is, you know, affecting disabled people in the sense that as services and support is whittled away, people become more isolated at home. It becomes increasingly important to be able to cook and keep warm and keep clean. And lots of disabled people are living in fuel poverty, and those are becoming choices rather than necessities. And finally, to stand shoulder to shoulder with the activists who have been so supportive of Deepak over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and the camp's made some efforts to make the camp friendly to kind of disabilities as well.
We're in a field and it is a camp, and there isn't huge amounts you can do, but there are simple things you can do to make things inclusive and accessible for as many people as you can. And the camp has certainly done those simple things, which have enabled our experience as disabled people to be on a level with everybody else's who's here and not have to worry about the barriers that this kind of environment would generally throw up. I think it's important that all of these kind of actions and camps involve disabled people, because we've been on the front line for the last couple of years, and you know, this organisation or this network and other networks around the country can only be really praised in the way that they've supported Deepak, you know, right across the country. And I would say that this time around, the anti-cuts movement and the broad left, the grassroots part of it, certainly has, you know, been more willing and more accepting and more practical about how they do their stuff to make sure they have been accessible and inclusive for everyone.
Yeah. I'm gonna read something really interesting that one girl gave to me this morning. She's been looking for it for a long time, and it's from the United Nations General Assembly Human Rights Council. Written statement submitted by UNANIMA, international and non-governmental organization in special consultative status. Hydraulic fracturing for natural gas, a new threat to human rights. We would like to express thanks and appreciation to the special rapporteur of the Human Right to Safe Drinking Water and Sanitation, Catarina de Albuquerque, for her official mission to the United States. While the U.S. can largely be considered water-rich relative to many other nations, some communities continue to face systemic violations of their human rights. In recent years, new threats have emerged, particularly in communities where natural gas deposits are being mined by the petroleum industry through the process of hydraulic fracturing, as well as in communities where groundwater is being mined for bottling, sometimes leading to water shortage for household consumption. Recognition of the human right to water and sanitation has made great strides in the past few years. The Human Rights Council's establishment of an independent expert in 2008, followed by resolutions at the General Assembly in July 2010 and HRC in September 2010, added to global momentum. The US has recently refined in position relative to the human right to water and sanitation, and deserves commendation for explaining its HRC vote by stating it is proud to take this significant step of joining consensus on this important resolution regarding the right to safe drinking water and sanitation, which is to be progressively realized. To fully realize and sustain the human right to water and sanitation, it is essential that the US engage in a process of policy reform and harmonization to put human rights first, address gaps in regulation, implementation and funding, minimize inequality and de facto discrimination, protect water resources and bolster data collection and rural oversight. Putting human rights at the center of national planning and policy will help ensure that basic needs and ecosystem protection are prioritized when balancing competing demands on water. The report documents several cases exemplifying an alarming pattern of placing private corporations, access to water above the rights of local communities and sustainability of hydrologic systems. We strongly support the special rapporteur's recommendation to view the right to water holistically by factoring it into policies that impact water quality, including agriculture, chemical use in products, and energy production. We also want to bring attention to the Council under the United States' affirmed commitment to the human right to water that hydraulic fracturing, a new technology that extracts gas from a mile or more deep underground, it's an emerging threat to affirming basic universal clean water and sanitation in the US. The oil and gas industry has begun conducting exploratory drilling in many parts of the world with plans to export this dangerous technology. Fracking in the United States. Over the past decade, there has been a rush for a new natural gas across America using a controversial and often polluting drilling method. Hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking, injects a mixture of water, sand and chemicals, many of them toxic under high pressure, into dense rock formations. Shale, tight sandstone or coal beds, to crack the rock and release natural gas. Fracking has been around for decades, but the techniques, technologies and chemicals used to reach new, remote gas reserves are more intensive and riskier than conventional gas drilling. The rapid expansion of this new form of fracking has brought rampant environmental and economic problems to rural communities. Accidents and leaks have polluted rivers, streams and drinking water supplies. Regions peppered with drilling rigs have high levels of smog as well as other airborne pollutants, including potential carcinogens. Rural communities face an onslaught of heavy truck traffic, often laden with dangerous chemicals used in drilling, and declining property values. The bridge fuel of fracking could well be a bridge to nowhere. Many residents exposed to toxic air and water pollution from gas drilling feel a sense of injustice by their threatened at the hands of the industry and lack of protection from the government. In 2009, fracking floods had so polluted wells in Demuck, Pennsylvania, that some families could no longer drink from their taps, and an Ohio house exploded after a fracked gas well leaked large volumes of methane into the home's water supply. Texas neighborhoods near fracked gas wells have high reported levels of airborne neurotoxins. Today, the oil and gas industry is loudly promoting natural gas production as a means of increasing American energy independence and national energy security. Industry representatives have specifically used this argument to lobby against federal oversight, and as noted in the Special Rapporteur's report in 2005, Congress granted exemption from the US. Safe Drinking Water Act industry gained the unique permission to inject toxic chemicals into the ground near water sources successfully lobbied by exemption. Between 2005 and 2010, the 10 largest natural gas producers and two trade associations spent more than $370 million lobbying for their interests. Fracking in Europe and South Africa. Only exploration permits have been granted in Europe to date, but civil society has reacted in strong opposition. French civil society drove the adoption of a nationwide ban on hydraulic fracturing. However, some are concerned that the ban could be easily overturned. Both Total and Exxon own permits in France and have suggested they will wait to see if the political climate becomes more favorable with the next government. In the United Kingdom, Quadrilla, a US company, began exploration in an area called Blackpool, but the project was controversial, and after two small earthquakes, Quadrilla was forced to halt activities. Some UK members of parliament have expressed vocal opposition to the project. So even though petroleum companies are promoting fracking as a cheaper, cleaner energy, politicians and communities are starting to raise doubts. Exploratory drilling has also begun in Poland and Bulgaria. These states are both dependent on Russia for their energy needs and close enough to the European gas market to make export possible if drilling can cover large deposits. ConocoPhillips is one of the companies planning to frack in Poland, where there has been minimal public awareness of the risks. The government has placed so much importance on independence from Russia that it is difficult to convince people of the risks. Two Canadian companies, LNG Petroleum and Transatlantic Petroleum, have purchased rights in Bulgaria, where civil society has been quite vocal, organizing protests in their cities with hundreds of protesters. An additional factor in Bulgaria and other European fracking zones is that contamination could become transboundary as many states source water from shared aquifers. The South African cabinet and some regions of Germany have also passed temporary moratorium until Doroth environmental impact assessment can be completed. As a relatively water-scarce country, South Africa would face particularly high ramifications if groundwater is contaminated. While industry sources are promoting fracking as a route to energy independence, there is no guarantee that gas produced will be available for local communities rather than for export. Recommendations: fracking poses unacceptable risks and should be banned globally. The United States can better provide national energy security through aggressively pursuing energy efficiency and renewable technology, for supporting the toxic extraction of shale gas. Every dollar spent on fracking is a dollar not spent pursuing renewable energy solutions that must eventually be adopted by counter global warming. Other states should heed the environmental destruction that fracking has caused in the US and ban the practice before it begins. Most immediately, the exemption from the U.S. Safe Drinking Water Act must be overturned and strong regulation must be put in place that safeguards fresh water sources and mandates greater transparency and disclosure within the industry.
Trying to put things in perspective for tomorrow before the mainstream media has its go. try and understand for myself and not lose sight of the big picture. People don't want fracking in Bolcombe. 85% of people don't want fracking. Yes, it's only a test drill, but that's not the point. This is a test case also. And it's the people that have looked into it, and count myself among those people, alongside the villagers who've had to educate themselves, have read the kind of peer-reviewed science and the think tanks, and muddled our way through the vested interests, and seen that this is a really bad idea from all kinds of points of view. But from Climate Radio's perspective, this is a bad idea because we cannot add more reserves of fossil fuels to the potentially those that are already potentially burnable and held by fossil fuel companies. Of the fossil fuels that we already have in fossil fuel reserves, we need to keep 80% of them in the ground if we are to conserve something vaguely resembling a livable planet. So there's a line in the sand here. People have been protesting peacefully. Now some people are prepared to take that a bit further and protest peacefully too, but to potentially put themselves at risk by breaking the law. That's a brave thing to do. That could threaten potential career moves in the future. You know, that's not something to be lightly set aside and discarded as kind of mob rule. The mainstream media tend to focus in on any conflict that happens in these kind of situations. But it's important to remember, you know, the thrust of what's going on here, that actually people are committed to non-violent protest and are doing the right thing. Let's have a debate about that. So there's light rain on the road, it's fairly dark, and I'm sure there's an owl I can hear in the distance. But anyway, I'm heading back to the camp to get a bit of sleep.
There were some concerts in the main tent every night.
Turn around to the hand, and over to the
Monday the 19th. A lot of people from the campsite Reclaim the Power is meeting at the main gate to start the direct action. We can observe how a group of united people make changes in the reality.
Well,
It's Monday morning. It's a beautiful day so far. Clouds have cleared, blue skies, very sunny, very warm. It's only 9 o'clock. Only 9 o'clock, and already two actions have taken place off site, one at the Bell Pottinger offices, a banner drop and a loop and what have you, targeting the PR company for the fracking industry in the UK. And the second action at the offices of Quadrilla. So we're down at the drill site, fairly quiet, lots of news people, Sky, BBC, ITN, all the usual suspects, indie media of various stripes, all down here. A third action off-site today. Somebody tweeted, it says, pro-fracking MP Francis Maud office is protest location number 3 today. A wind turbine blade with more wind painted on it has been delivered. Francis Maud, the local MP who appointed Lord Brown to the Cabinet Office. Lord Brown, the chair of Quadrilla. This is what democracy looks like in Britain in 2013. So can you tell us about the three actions that have kicked off already this morning?
Well, before even 9 o'clock, before people had even had their breakfast, Reclaim the Power activists had blockaded and occupied Quadrilla's headquarters in Lichfield. Also, Reclaim the Power activists blockaded and scaled the roof of Bell Pottinger, a PR agency for Quadrilla, and dropped a banner saying fracking liars, because there's evidence that a Bell Pottinger PR spokesperson told activists, and it's recorded, that everything they say is basically fucking bullshit. And so this quote that was recorded has been blaring out of a loudspeaker out of those offices. So the PR damage to the PR company is huge today, and it's been a media circus. So it's delivered a real blow to Quadrilla and the dirty PR company they're using. And the other exciting action that just happened now is an activist delivered a wind turbine blade to pro-fracking local Balcombe MP Francis Maud, who a lot of Balcombe residents really hate. And they've delivered this with a note to Francis. Francis wouldn't respond to them. Not clear whether he was in his constituency office or not, but they have left the blade on his roof. So there you go, it's just there, and it's a reminder of what people want. So three actions already, there are more to come, and at the moment we're outside the gate of the Quadrilla compound and exciting things are going to happen.
Okay, brilliant. Francis Maud, also I remember the person that hired Lord Brown into the Cabinet Office.
Yeah, I mean, it's a revolving door between the fossil fuel industry, kind of military corporations, private military security companies, and government. You can see how strategic the sector is and how the state organizes to perpetuate it and control it. And that's to the detriment of people who, of all of us, who could really benefit from the decentralization and the democratization of energy that renewable energy can bring. So, you know, when we're taking all this action and when we're organising, we don't just want the end of a fossil fuel industry, which has to happen if we're to avert catastrophic climate change, but we also want energy democracy and to reclaim our power, not just the energy that we use, but the power to take decisions about our lives and what should be a commons, and that includes energy, but it also includes the right to education, the right to health and a health service, right to control our own labour, and you know, as well as the atmospheric commons and land and food security. So this connects a lot of dots, what we're doing here, and we really hope to continue that kind of thinking and that kind of activism for securing real genuine participatory democracy and a commons.
So we've had three direct actions off-site this morning. Do you think they're good targets?
I think they're very interesting targets, well selected. The action at Francis Maud's office, particularly the local MP for this area. Now, Francis Maud is a supporter of fracking, but more importantly, perhaps, is he appointed Quadrilla's boss to government 3 years ago. So the boss of Quadrilla, Lord Brown, works in the Cabinet Office, and he was put there by Francis Maud, which I suspect is why protesters are outside his house, I think. I know Lord Brown has had four meetings in 8 months in the last year with DEC, which seems a suspicious amount of activity for somebody who is not involved with DEC, and that's not. And there's other sources in DEC say that Don Brown is often in DEC on informal business, if you like.
Just quickly about the other two sites.
Well, obviously Lichfield is Quadrilla's headquarters, so it's going to be very difficult for them to coordinate their response to what's going on here with their headquarters at least partially out of action. And again, the same with Bell Pottinger, because Bell Pottinger is their PR company, and if they can't get the messages out attempting to rebut what's going on here, then that puts them in a very difficult position. So all in all, you know, three very well selected targets, and thought out, because here is the focus of interest, and that's obviously taken attention away from any other potential targets. So it's 10 o'clock Monday morning, and I look forward to seeing what else is going to happen today.
Say what's been happening here and why you're supporting it.
What I'm supporting is people being prepared to literally take a stand against fracking. They don't do it lightly, but I think when you look at the evidence that suggests we need to keep 2/3 of known fossil fuel reserves in the ground if we're to have any hope of keeping below 2 degrees warming, then taking action like this in a peaceful way is a really important way of sending a very clear message, because these people have tried to write to their MPs, they've tried to raise it in lots of other ways. I have organised debates in Parliament about this, I've put down questions and so forth, and basically we've got a government that's not listening. And I think if this is a peaceful way that we can send that message even more firmly and even more strongly, then it's a really important thing to do.
Okay, and physically, what's the situation here right now?
Of course, your radio, not TV, so I better describe it to you. Basically, we've got a number of people, maybe half a dozen people, who have locked themselves onto a wheelchair in the centre of the driveway up to the gate that leads onto the site. And then others have sat around in solidarity with them. There's maybe, I don't know, maybe 50, 60 people, maybe more actually, who are gathered around with banners, very peacefully bearing witness to what's happening. The atmosphere is very calm. We've been warned by the police so far that if we don't move, we may risk arrest. But looking around, people look very, very determined.
Okay. Are you prepared to risk arrest yourself today?
I'm prepared to risk arrest myself because I believe passionately in this cause. The reason I got into politics was because I want to ensure a livable planet into the future. You know, we've tried through conventional democratic means, and I'll keep trying that way. But as long as it remains peaceful and non-violent, I think there is a role for this kind of action as well, yes.
Swoop of people arriving. About 100 people, cyclists and pedestrians coming from the camp, joining the people at the gate here.
Thank you.
Four people with arm locks in a circle in front of the gate, just assembled. Just in front of a police line. In a kind of diamond shape, yeah, four people locked on in a kind of diamond shape. Police trying to isolate people. Kind of some kind of virtual kettle attempt. Line of police trying to block people in at the gate.
One of the most important things to make real changes is information. Finally, we can observe a big police operation.
Around 11, the police were just starting to surround people at that point. Can you say what happened after that?
The police line on one side of the camp was continuously attempting to push forward to kettle the protesters in a much smaller area, and they made three pushes that were repelled by the protesters. We managed to keep them, stop them and push them back, and then, which was, cause it felt like quite an achievement because there was a very large number of them and they're very heavily armed. So they tried to push us three times and we resisted them three times, and then the fourth time, with an enormous number of officers, managed to push us and clear the kettle into a much smaller area. So there was a lot of argy-bargy, pushing and shoving. There were officers, one officer pushed me by my face with his hand clamped around my face. My friend had her neck squeezed and she was pushed back with the officer squeezing her neck. We were chanting things like, "We are peaceful," and making no aggressive move to them whatsoever, and they were extremely vocally aggressive and physically aggressive to us, and I know there'll be some complaints made about some of the police behaviour in that scenario. Maybe that went on for an hour and a half or something like that.
And no provocation at all?
No, there was absolutely no provocation in any way, just a completely peaceful demonstrators just simply not wishing to be kettled within a tiny area.
And a number of the police were snatching people out of that kettle as well, and arresting some people?
Yeah, lots of people were snatched again, some people quite violently, and lots of people have been arrested today. I'm not sure on the numbers. Also, there's been quite a few people de-arrested today, which is good as well.
Can you explain the phrase de-arrested for people?
So when the snatch squads come in and they try to drag somebody out, sometimes it's possible for the demonstrators to surround the person that's being dragged away and drag them back, basically, to prevent the police from arresting them. So yes, that's happened on quite a few occasions today, quite a large number of successful de-arrests.
And Caroline Lucas amongst the arrestees?
Apparently she's just texted to say that somebody's just texted to say that's definitely the case, that she's been arrested, yeah. The last group of people that are near to the gate, which is a group of lock-ons, so there's four men who are locked together with arm tubes, so that means that they've got tubes around their arms and they're gripped onto each other within these arm tubes, so that makes it very difficult for the police to move them. So yeah, there's four lock-ons that are still down there, and then there's I think three supporters with the four lock-ons, and those are the only people that are still remaining within the area in front of the gate. And just a few moments ago, some kind of big van full of specialist police that are obviously trained in some way to deal with lock-ons have just turned up, so they're just taking apart the arm lock-ons now, so I'm not sure how they're going to do that really.
How would you describe the atmosphere overall over the last few hours?
It's a strange atmosphere today because the demonstrators here are so peaceful, so there's a very, very strong peaceful element, lots of music, lots of dancing, lots of singing, and then also some nervousness because of the level of police aggression that's happened today.
You look a little bit shocked yourself.
I am a tiny little bit shocked, just because the front line that we're pushing back against the police when the police were trying to push us was made up of lots of women, lots of local activists who were older activists, elderly people. So some of the quite intense violence and pushing that was happening was extremely large officers and old people and women. They weren't like fighting aggressive big guys or anything like that. They were really pushing and shoving, and as I say, pushing people by the face and pushing people by the neck, elderly people and women, a lot of them.
It was amazing to see you in the middle of the scrum today, sat down in the middle of the blockade. Would you like to say a little bit how the day's been for you?
Yeah, it's been a real example of solidarity, of teamwork, of how people coming together can work together to carry off something regardless of, you know, police presence and everything else. I think today, right across the board, has been poking the government, the company, and everybody involved with them in the eye. And I think we've really taken the battle back to them and put it on their doorsteps. And I think this action here today at the gate was about reinforcing the message that the locals and the permanent camp have been saying for the last few weeks. And I think it was a really successful operation, and I think we managed to pull off exactly what we tried to. It's dull in its predictability at this point. It really is. You know, that they have no answer apart from aggression, trying to dominate spaces that really, you know, they would be better trying to liaise and negotiate through the process. And actually lots of people were arrested today and harmed today when it really wasn't necessary. The mood was really upbeat. There was a fantastic atmosphere, and it was over-policing, and it was unnecessary.
Did you experience any police aggression at any point?
Not myself personally, but I saw lots of people whipped off who really didn't need to be, you know. At the end, we were asked to leave, and we were trying to reach that decision as a group, to try and reach consensus. They gave us time to do that, and halfway through, just started pulling people out when we hadn't even finished the discussion or really began it. We're talking within a minute, you know, so we were really sold a pup. And it was unnecessary because actually they make themselves look knobs, because the decision we reached was to get up and leave. So they started arresting people and pulling people when it was completely unnecessary.
Yeah. So people maintained the kind of moral upper hand and the kind of won out at the end of the day?
I think so. I think the message is that actually we came, despite the mainstream media's obsession with violence and all the rest of it, I think we showed today that we carried out creative actions that were non-violent, that we took spaces without any aggression, without feeling the need to assert ourselves in that physical way. And what we did was we did what we intended to do all along, and we didn't buy into the, you know, into the idea that this was going to be a mob rule, you know, attack on the land or attack on the police. This was about reinforcing the message of the people who have been campaigning here before we came, and the people who will be campaigning here or after we leave, you know. And it's really important that that's the message that comes out of today, that these are the guys, their actions have brought us here, and we've been here to reinforce what they've been doing, and hopefully to bring some more attention so that actually when we leave that they can get the support and the profile that you know, that their actions and their bravery deserves, really. Yeah.
Thank you.
up.
It's incredible how united people can avoid being defeated. Thanks for listening. Resonance FM 104.4.